funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who will pay the price of climate change and who might reap the profits? Even as flood, drought, rising sea levels, and falling food production create huge losses in certain parts of the world, entrepreneurs positioned to sell protection or relief or to exploit newly accessible natural resources could come away winners. My guest today has traveled all over the world to see such efforts in action, and he has observed some stark differences in likely outcomes for the world's haves and have-nots. The new book by journalist Mackenzie Funk is called Windfall, The Booming Business of Global Warming. He's in town to speak to the World Affairs Council this evening at 7 o'clock. Mackenzie, welcome back to Think.
Thank you for having me.
So if there is one thing that becomes really evident reading this book, it's that climate change is going to have deeply uneven effects around the world.
Yeah, and it wasn't clear to me immediately, actually, that this was the big thing with climate change. It wasn't until I traveled, I started in the Arctic and I ended up in places like Bangladesh and Senegal. And of course, it's not just the effects are uneven, it's also who can pay for the salves, basically.
Well, in a case like Bangladesh, this is a country that has contributed very little to the problem and yet is absolutely going to absorb a great amount of the problem itself.
Yeah, and for better or worse, that's the case almost across the board. Those countries that have contributed the most carbon into the atmosphere are the ones that have generally been richer, and the ones that are richer can pay for these things. Also, by happenstance, many of them are in the north, and so the north is going to warm up in ways that might even be good in some places, and more heat in the center of the world is generally not good.
Let's talk about the Arctic for a minute. First of all, there's this great irony that melting ice is exposing a lot more deposits of things like fossil fuels.
Yeah. The starkest example is Greenland, where melting ice is actually obviously causing a lot of sea level rise, or expected to cause a lot of sea level rise across the world. But Greenland itself, because of that same melt, will actually rise. It's got so much weight of the ice on the bedrock that when that weight goes away, it will actually rise up. So in that narrow sense, it won't be damaged by what's happening on the ice itself. But, of course, as the ice pulls back, minerals on land will sometimes get revealed. I went to a mine called the Black Angel, which is way down a fjord, and it had the highest grade zinc in the world. And when it opened in the 70s, they thought they got all they could. And when zinc prices were high again in the mid-2000s, some geologists went back to see, okay, well, should we open this again? Is it worth getting a little bit more because the zinc is so high quality? First of all, the shipping season was two months longer every year. Mm-hmm. There was so much less ice in the fjord that they could get in and out. The second thing was that on a day hike, one of the geologists was walking around. He saw that the foot of this glacier had pulled back, and underneath where the glacier had been was this deposit of zinc just as big as the first. And so it was a very clear case of, well, climate change is warmed the earth enough, the glaciers pulled back, and hey, here's a new deposit. And so they opened up the mine again.
It is still an ecologically sensitive part of the environment, though.
Absolutely. And, Greenlanders, to their credit, are worried about the effects of what would be an oil spill. If you know about oil spills and how they clean them up, and unfortunately many people around here do, you do a lot of chemical dispersants. You do all sorts of skimmers, all sorts of ways to clean up an oil spill that absolutely wouldn't work in ice. In ice, the best method, so far as I know, is to burn it. You literally burn the oil off the surface, and that's what you can do. So they're worried about oil spills. They're worried about tailings from these mines being dumped in the fjords, which is what happened before. At the same time, for Greenlanders, who I didn't entirely realize before I went there, that there are 57,000 Greenlanders. They're part of Denmark. They've been a colony of Denmark for more than 100 years. They want independence. Right now, they can't get it because basically they can't pay their own way. They get a lot of money from Denmark every year. And their idea is that if they open up all these mines and they open themselves up to oil drilling, they can get the money to pay their own way and they can get their independence. So they're balancing these two things. They're balancing the potential degradation to the environment that has sustained them until now, and then this desire, which is completely valid, to have an independent country, to be their own people.
How are traditional industries in Greenland changing as the climate changes?
Well, there's not much traditional industry in Greenland aside from fishing, and that's become more industrial. There's a lot of tourism now. That's not traditional, but it's been around long enough to be a relatively big thing. Fishing hasn't been directly hurt, and there's preliminary evidence that it's actually being helped. Certain fish species are moving into their waters, and there's still a lot of fishing that goes on there. It's still their number one export. The tourism is doing quite well. People want to come and see the glaciers fall into the sea, and you can see the fastest moving glacier in the world, Ilulissat, in one of the main tourist towns. You can sit there in a beautiful hotel and actually watch the glaciers pour into the bay. And I think a survey that came out maybe, or a study that came out maybe 2 weeks ago, shows that this glacier has sped up to a speed that's never been seen before in history. It was something, I can't remember the number, but it's massive. It's just picking up pace.
That has to be surreal to actually watch this sort of thing happening.
Yeah, it is. And obviously the glaciers have always dumped icebergs into this bay. In fact, the one that the Titanic hit came from here, most likely. But to see it speeding up, and to see all the tourists coming, and this is what they're looking at, this is what they know about Greenland, and then to walk in into some of these shops, I've got a postcard for my wife that says climate change, and then it's a picture of a glacier there in Greenland. You know, it's becoming one of the things they can sell to the world. They're the front lines.
So I think back to high school history, and it feels like we spent about a year and a half studying the search for the Northwest Passage, which was something that for hundreds of years, explorers, it was like the Holy Grail. And now it looks like there will be one at least several months a year.
That's true. Of course, when they finally did discover the Northwest Passage, they found that it was covered in ice. And so all that hunting was for naught. And it's open. You know, when I started reporting this book, 2006, 2007, it was the first time that satellites were showing that there was this crack in the ice. You could actually see a way in the summertime to get a boat through. And that's been happening. You know, sailboats have gone through. This tourist boat called The World. It's like a live-in condos that float around the world. They went through. Last summer, the first bulk carrier of goods went through the Northwest Passage. It was carrying coal. And
there's an irony there, too.
No, a little bit. But the Northwest Passage may actually not be the grail that people expected for a few reasons. It's a little bit shallower than we would want for shipping, industrial-scale shipping. And also the way the ice is breaking up in the Arctic. When it melts in the summer, it's a sort of like a yarmulke on a bald man's head, mm-hmm. and the wind blows in the wrong direction, and it crumples right there in the Canadian archipelago, those islands above North America. And it all gets stuck there. All the thick pack ice gets stuck there around the Northwest Passage. So it's actually the last place to open many summers in the Arctic. The Northern Sea Route, Northeast Passage, which goes across the top of Russia, that's the one that is seeing the real boom. And shipping may actually happen over the top of the world, over the Bald Patch, faster than it happens through the Northwest Passage. And so the boom in the Northeast Passage and the Northern Sea Route has been significant if you look at the pace, and maybe not so significant if you look at the total numbers. I think it was 80 ships last year did it, but that's up from zero a couple years ago.
How is all that new activity likely to affect geopolitical relations in the region?
Well, the early thing, you know, the way I got on this story actually is I was sent on a Canadian military mission to the Arctic, to the Northwest Passage. And the idea was that as this ice goes away, and the shipping route is here, people are going to try to go through the Northwest Passage, and Canada wants to say, this is ours. This is our territory. And lots of somewhat obscure legal arguments on both sides. But the U.S., the European Union, China, everyone else wants to say, this is a strait. This is just like Gibraltar. If we want to go through, we can. So, you know, Canada was up there with guns, with warships. We camped out on the ice, and we looked pretty tough, I suppose. And I'm not sure it actually matters. I'm not sure, first of all, I don't think America's really worried about war with Canada or vice versa. People talk a lot about Russia, and Russia planted the flag at the North Pole. They're certainly adding military muscle up in the Arctic. But the way I've looked at it is, if you've got this big chunk of the world that everyone thought was sort of, you know, common heritage and there for everybody, and then five coastal states, you know, that's the U.S. through Alaska, Canada, Greenland, and Denmark, as one, Norway and Russia, if those five get to claim huge chunks of the Arctic, which, again, through various legal means they can, then are they really going to fight in one another? It's like if you're at a birthday party and a bunch of kids get huge chunks of cake, are they really going to get too mad when one gets a slightly bigger piece? I don't think so. And that's the response of most security people I talk to. The Arctic is not the place where security issues are really going to be a big deal. Sure, we're going to add ships. We're going to get militaries up there. We'll make it another ocean as it opens up. But will we fight over it? Probably not. The fights are going to be elsewhere.
Well, one thing that is already causing people to prepare for security concerns is this idea that there will be climate refugees in many parts of the world. Can you talk about the countries that are bracing for this and why they're positive that they don't want to open their borders to people who might come over after losing everything?
Yeah, and you're right that that's the main thing. If you talk to people in the government, in the U.S. government, that's what they worry about. They worry about refugees coming across. And these climate refugees, because if we're the world's policeman, if the U.S. is the world's policeman, then we'll get involved. And of course, big mass movements of people are what set off fights. I went to India and Bangladesh. India is building the world's largest border fence around Bangladesh. And the reason they started building it was not climate change. There's a long history of influx of Bangladeshis. India doesn't necessarily like them, and they want to enclose Bangladesh. But increasingly, you hear local activists, sort of the Minutemen equivalent, saying, we've got to close this off because climate change is going to cause all these people to stream over the borders. And so they're walking the border and they're walking the fence and finding gaps and notifying authorities that there's this problem. The defense establishment in Delhi talks about climate refugees from Bangladesh and what this could mean. Another case is Europe. You know, if you look at, there's migration into Europe of Africans. It's much like the migration of Latin Americans into the United States. And that comes via all sorts of ways. From Senegal, where I visited, people would often get in these boats, old fishing boats, and they would make their way to the Canary Islands, which once they get a toehold in Europe, then you can usually find your way the rest of the way. Other routes take you across the Sahara and then into Libya. And in the pre-Qaddafi days, there was a deal between Italy and, or pre-Qaddafi's death days, there was a deal between Qaddafi and Italy for Qaddafi to get all this money and all sorts of trade agreements. And one thing he would do was keep the Africans, the sub-Saharan Africans, there in Libya. He wouldn't let them cross. He wouldn't let them get on boats and go to southern Italy or Malta, which is where they'd often end up. He would, in fact, have these sort of desert refugee camps, which were quite brutal places, as I understand it. And he was paid off by Italy to do so. There's a new European border agency called Frontex, and their whole job is to basically seal off the southern edge of Europe. And I visited Malta, which is a small island off the coast of Italy. It's its own country. It's one of the most densely populated islands in the entire world after Singapore. And it sees a lot of migrants coming from Libya, basically not Libyans, but usually sub-Saharan Africans, fleeing a changing climate and other problems. And they'll end up there because their boats have been blown off course. And when they get there, they're thrown in jail for 18 months. Mandatory is to keep them scared.
My guest is journalist Mackenzie Funk. His new book is called Windfall, The Booming Business of Global Warming. He's in town to address the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth tonight at 7 o'clock. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, send email to think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you, the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Mackenzie Funk, author of the new book Windfall, The Booming Business of Global Warming. He's in town to address the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth tonight at 7 o'clock. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Mackenzie, there's been so much talk of artificial snow in Sochi since the Olympics began. I will confess, first of all, that I would not have guessed in a million years that the world experts in this are Israelis.
Well, to be fair, the people in Sochi did not go with the Israelis in the end. They went with a Finnish guy, so he's pretty northerly. But the Israelis did have a very strong bid for what they call their all-weather snowmaker, which is perfect for places like Sochi because it can operate in all conditions. And snowmaking is this business that has obviously taken off. Anyone who's gone skiing sees the snow guns all over the slopes. It's a billion-dollar business now. And skiers across the world, not just Sochi, although they've got something like 400 guns, are using it. In Austria, where I visited to see this all-weather snowmaker, the Austrian Alps use as much water on their snowmakers as does the entire city of Vienna.
Wow.
So it's this massive thing. And that brings some problems, of course, that amount of water use. But also, as temperature rises, the traditional snowmakers can only operate under certain humidity conditions. They need, of course, near-freezing temperatures or below to work. And that isn't always happening when it's most needed. And so that brings us to the Israelis. I don't know how I stumbled upon this, but I found that the Israelis were marketing, in part because of climate change, this device that had come out of desalination technology. And you'll have to bear with me as I do the technology here.
This wonky part's my favorite, so go right
ahead. Okay. So two engineers both were sent to gulags in Russia. One was Polish, one was Russian. The one was named Zarchin. And he was sent to a gulag in northern Siberia, where, like many places in the Arctic, it's very cold, but it's also very dry. It's actually almost a desert. And they found at this gulag that they couldn't actually get enough fresh water. So Zarchin and the others came up with this ingenious solution, which was to build a pond and let a bunch of seawater rush in the summer, and then they would dam it off. And then in the cold winter, the pond would freeze, and as you know, snow when it freezes, or water when it freezes, even salt water that separates the salt particles from the water itself. Snow doesn't have any salt in it, or at least not much. And so then when spring would come again, they would let the water, the hypersaline water, sort of go out the bottom of the dam, and they would measure the salinity as it went out. And when it was drinkable, they would say, okay, and they would shut off this dam, and then would let all the snow melt, all the ice melt on this pond, and then they'd have a whole pond of drinking water. So when Zarchin went to Israel, he came to Israel a decade later, perhaps. He saw that this country was in dire need of water, and he became one of the original desalination engineers who kind of wanted to turn Israel into what they'd known, which is a little bit more green in Eastern Europe. And, of course, you don't have a lot of freezing temperatures in Israel. So he said, well, we can do a vacuum. You know, if you lower the pressure enough, you can either lower the temperature or you can lower pressure to freeze water. So he would lower the pressure. So it's just basically a giant vacuum chamber. And he would separate the ice and the salt that way. Turns out to be a very inefficient way to do desalination. And Israel quickly moved on to what we now see popping up all over the world, which is this reverse osmosis technology. Basically a bunch of membranes, a bunch of filters you force the water through, and that gets the salt out. That's better. In the meantime, the Israelis had inadvertently invented kind of the best way to do snowmaking, to make ice through these vacuum chambers. And it was up to another engineer who'd been sent to a gulag in Kazakhstan, where he'd learned to ski to and from school in blizzards both ways, he said. He was the best skier at Israel Desalination Enterprises, he liked to tell his colleagues. And one day he saw this vacuum technology at use in South Africa. They were using it to cool this deep gold mine. And they were testing it on the surface in 100-degree heat in South Africa, and he saw this giant pile of snow, and he said, hey, this is great snowmaking. And so they flew down a Finnish guy, actually. They flew down an expert skier, as they were called, and this expert Finnish skier tested out the snow and said it was pretty good. And they started marketing these vacuum things all over. There's now one in Pitztal in Austria in the Alps. There's one in Zermatt. They've got a new portable model that they hope to sell to skiers everywhere else. And it's a remarkable thing.
I'm not really a skier, but it seems to me that if you are one, clearly you want snow when you have made your reservations to go somewhere, and people are willing to pay a premium for this. What happens to all that water that is sort of pumped onto the mountain when nature is not providing snow? Is it able to be reabsorbed into the water table?
Yeah, and that's an important thing. It's a question of, I suppose, if it's in the right place, as is always the question with water. There's never going to be any more or less water in the world. It's just a matter of where it is and whether it's where the people are. That is the case with some snowmaking, that it takes it to places where it's not as useful for the other uses. In general, the interesting interface between water and snow is that glaciers and snowfields are our best source of storing water. I mean, that's a natural reservoir. And so if you look at the drought that's happening in California at the moment, that's in part because there's less snowpack in the Sierra Nevada and up in the high peaks above the Colorado River. And as that perennial snow goes away, then the water storage goes away. And so you see all the water will rush down in the spring and it won't sort of trickle out over the summer months when it's most needed from these snowfields. And that's really the issue. You know, we're not going to run out of water. It's just the way we've gotten it and built our society around the way we've gotten water for all these years, that's going away.
We live in a lot of places that are not necessarily water dense. They're nice places to live if you can pipe water in, but otherwise there's not enough to sustain large populations.
Yeah, and for better or worse, a lot of the growth has been in the Sun Belt in this country. And a lot of the water, of course, isn't there. And we're getting less and less water, and at least until recently, more and more people.
What's a water hedge fund?
Well, there are a few of them. And water hedge funds do... Until recently, they would do things like invest in water utilities. It's actually kind of boring. They would invest in better valves and pipes, you know, things that I think are good. They help with efficiency. So a lot of water efficiency measures or utilities, which is a couple people admitted to me. If you're in a hedge fund and you're looking for giant returns, do you really want to invest in something that's controlled by a government entity and you can't just jack up the rates when water is scarce? No. So utilities are actually the dummy's bet for water investing, and they saw a ton of money go in after an inconvenient truth, after sort of awareness of climate change peaked in 2007. There was a ton of money going toward water. There's something like 15 new water funds, investment funds, hedge funds, mutual funds. Now, the smart guys realized that in parts of this country and other places like Australia, you can separate the water rights from the property rights. You can actually own water. That's true in Texas. And they said, well, why are we investing in, you know, these valves? Why are we investing in water utilities when we could get the thing itself? And so that's what the cutting edge of water investing is going out and bundling water rights, basically going to old ranchers and saying, hey, your sons aren't here to farm this land. Would you like to sell us your water? And in the American West, that's often a case of just getting enough of these ranchers' water rights bundled together and then selling it to maybe a boomtown downstream. In Australia, it is perhaps going to the equivalent ranchers in Australia, buying their water rights, the permanent rights, and then renting the water back to those people. So they see their sort of their underlying investment gaining in value. That's the water. And then they're getting some revenue every month as the ranchers pay for the water they once owned.
Are there people sitting back on the water they own and waiting to release these, pardon the pun, liquid assets until the market is paying more for water?
It's somewhat hard to do. You can see people who are creating artificial aquifers, for instance, and doing this sort of storage thing, thinking that in moments like California's drought or what's been happening in Texas for too many months of late, they're thinking that these will be very useful, but you can't just sit on water. Water rights in general, at least for surface water, it doesn't work like that. You've got to put it to beneficial use, is the law. You've got to, once you stick a straw in a river, you've got to keep on sucking and show that you're doing something with it, or the right goes away. So in most cases, they'll have to put it to use. And they might, of course, be sitting on it in the sense that they're running a ranch. You know, it's a hedge fund running a ranch when they're not really ranchers. And they're going to eventually sell it to someone else. But they can't just sit on it, no.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Bert in Dallas. Hello, Bert.
Hi. Global warming, the progress of the predictions is happening faster and more severely, along the predicted spectrum than what you have, what you've heard about 10 years ago even. And now you see the drought in California, you see drought in Texas, as you mentioned, and I'm wondering where the food production could shift, and could that shift occur quickly enough to really stop a disruption,
I don't think it could happen quickly enough to stop a disruption. In fact, there are some people betting that it won't. And one thing I reported on in the book was this thing that activists call the farmland grab. And it's when people go out to places like Africa. And when I say people, we're talking sovereign wealth funds from Gulf states or hedge funds or investment funds from the United States or Chinese farmers and investors and government entities trying to buy up farmland in places where the water is. And so I went to South Sudan where a hedge fund manager had tried, possibly gotten, it's unclear whether his papers were all in order, but he tried to get 400,000 hectares of land, that's an area bigger than Delaware, to farm. And this is happening tons in Ethiopia, Cambodia, Ukraine, any place that's near China, parts of Russia that are underpopulated, where people are going and trying to buy this farmland to grow the food. And in the one sense of just meeting overall need of food, there might be some good things to that. If places that were subsistence agriculture or no agriculture at all become more industrialized, then we could meet these food needs. Whether that's what will happen is an open question. Activists are certainly worried about obviously by naming it the farmland grab, they're worried about this. But there is an argument to be said that this will help us meet these needs. In this country, projections for the Midwest show that some places where we grew corn just will not be viable. They're already becoming not viable. And maybe Canada is the place to go. But it's not, the dirt matters a lot. And so the Canadian Shield, that's some rock that you can't really grow a lot of food on. And so it's not like Canada is automatically going to get the kind of growing that we've had in the Midwest. It's not automatic at all. So we could be, we built so much infrastructure based on this climate that who knows? I don't think people are hopeful.
It's interesting as well in the developing world that there might be places that, on the one hand, you let market forces do their thing and maybe it does solve a problem economically. However, theoretically, you could have a region that is producing a great deal of food where hunger is endemic because all of that food is exported to someone who paid for the rights to the land a long time ago.
Yeah, and Ethiopia is the main case that people point there. It's not clear that much, if any, of the food that's being grown there now by these big industrial schemes is being eaten by Ethiopians, obviously. Ethiopia is famous for its famines. It's not having one now. But a lot of that food is going to the Gulf states. There are Indian firms there. There are some Westerners. So the globalization is almost as big a trend as climate change here. And we have very easy ways to get products from where they are to where they're paid for, I suppose. And my favorite case was these sheep that were, I think it was Abu Dhabi, put some sheep on an airplane and they flew them to Vietnam. They grew them there, or rather fed them there. And when they got fat enough, they were put back on an airplane and they were eaten somewhere in Abu Dhabi. Now, this is the kind of thing that's happening.
How much does that meat cost per pound?
I have no idea.
I guess if you're from Abu Dhabi, maybe you can.
I think you can afford it, yeah.
Afford that. Well, talk about this. Dutch engineers are considered around the world to be sort of the masters at storm surge protection. And clearly that is because they have a long history of keeping their country, which is below sea level, protected from inundation. Talk about some of the places that are looking to import Dutch technology and what kinds of strategies exist to protect low-lying areas from storm surge.
Sure. Well, I think it's fair to say that any place that is rich enough to pay for any sort of defenses at all is looking at Dutch technology. And so, the San Francisco Bay Area, they're looking at it. New York City, New York Harbor, they're looking at it. Even places like the Maldives, which are poor in parts but also very rich because of tourism, they're trying to figure out what they could do. The Dutch the Dutch are not as worried about climate change as you would imagine in such a low-lying country. If you look at these indices of the greatest climate risk that some consultants put out, you know, the Netherlands is not even close to the bottom. They're up near the top. They're near Norway. And it's because they're so good at sort of coming together and building dikes, building seawalls, building these storm surge barriers. And they've got this sort of governmental system set up to deal with this, that adding a couple feet to what they already have is not as big a deal as you would imagine. And so, you know, traveling around the Netherlands when I was there, they talk about climate change as an opportunity. That's the main thing today. Well, let's look at this as an opportunity. What that means in New York City, for instance, is a seawall that one design would go across the Narrows, that's below the Verrazano Bridge that stretches between Staten Island and Brooklyn, and then some smaller ones to block off other areas that water could get in and get Manhattan. It's a massive span. It's two giant arms, you know, as big as the Eiffel Tower or maybe the Statue of Liberty, would pop, and they would sort of slowly, as a storm surge came, they would come across and close in the middle of that area there, and then other smaller gates would come up from the bottom. You'd only close them when a storm surge is coming, when there's a Hurricane Sandy, and otherwise water would get in and out and ships would get in and out. And that would be something modeled basically on something on a storm surge barrier they have in Rotterdam called the Maasland Barrier, Maasland Caring, Rotterdam being the big port in the Netherlands and in actually the biggest in Europe. I think the most interesting and scary technology is the floating technology, which is the idea that the Maldives could, if its beaches get inundated, they could just build new ones that float and put the tourists on that.
My guest is journalist Mackenzie Funk. We're talking about his new book, Windfall, The Booming Business of Global Warming. He'll be addressing the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth this evening at 7 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, send email to think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you, the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Mackenzie Funk. His new book is called Windfall, The Booming Business of Global Warming. He'll be addressing the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth this evening at 7. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So just back for a moment, Mackenzie, to this idea of diverting storm surges. That extra water has to go somewhere, right? It doesn't just sink into the bottom of the ocean. What happens to it?
Yeah, I took these storm surge barriers as sort of a metaphor for a lot of these technologies, these things that would be good if you're on the right side of them or if you're the one holding the levers. But with a storm surge, of course, the water hits the barrier and then it has to go somewhere. It doesn't disappear. And in the case of this one in Manhattan, they guessed it would be, or this one protecting Manhattan, protecting Wall Street, they guessed it would be an extra 2 feet that would flood into areas in Brooklyn and Staten Island. So those are a lot of the same neighborhoods that got hit very hard by Hurricane Sandy would get hit harder, I guess.
And once again, it boils down to whether or not you have the money to construct one of these things to protect yourself.
Well, yeah, in that sense, you know, it's like these shades of gray. You know, if you're in Manhattan, you're likely going to be protected the farther you are away if they were to build this thing, and it's not clear that they will. It's not clear that it's possible to build anything like this in this country. But the farther you are away from it, the less protected you are. And that's the same thing with the borders in Europe or even in this country. You know, people will maybe try to migrate to these places that are relatively safe, but if they can't get in, they can't get in.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Jerome in Haltom City. Hi, Jerome.
Hi. I have a question for your guest, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
What I guess I hear from what he's saying is that there's big money to be made in global warming. And I am very concerned because I've heretofore assumed that the skeptics were really didn't believe that there is global warming, but now I'm wondering if there's more to it than that. How would he sell the idea that global warming is real to a skeptic? And does he think that that people have some kind of nefarious motives because they can make money in this process?
Thanks for your call, Jerome.
Yeah, good, very good questions. I suppose there are two of them. So I'll take the second one, which is, do I think there's a nefarious thing going on here? Are people denying climate change because they think they can get rich off it? I guess it's what people say about Halliburton, right? They want more war so they can make more money. I don't think that's right. At least from what I saw, most companies are more, it's more like they're hedging their bets. It's more like, yeah, climate change is going to be bad, but maybe I can make it less bad. And a great example of this is actually Royal Dutch Shell. You know, you would not think that an oil company, one, would believe in climate change, or two, would be sort of preparing for it in the way they are.
Well, they can't afford not to, right?
Well, right. Any company like this that's got stockholders, it's got to make a profit. It's got to believe in reality. You know, ExxonMobil now, after years of funding climate denial, they actually, on their website, you can go there and see, we believe climate change is bad for society and should be dealt with. And so a lot of these companies and a lot of investment funds, I mean, it's going to hurt their bottom line. And what they're doing is trying to minimize that. And, you know, in Shell's case, you might say that their push to drill in the Arctic as the ice pulls back is part of that. You might say that their move into natural gas, which is a little less carbon intensive than oil, is part of that. And that's what they say. With these giant investment funds that are climate focused, you'd see a lot of their money going towards solar panels and all these kind of things you would expect. And it's a little less of it that's going toward, say, seawall builders. So, but as I talk to these people, none of them say, yeah, let's let the planet burn. Let's get rich off it. I think it's a little bit more complicated than that. The second question is how would I talk to a skeptic about climate change and try to convince them? First of all, I think it's really hard because it's gone beyond what's the science, and it's gone more into the beliefs. It's gone really into sort of political identity. And you see, if you look at the social science on this, you see that the country is increasingly split, that liberals tend to believe in climate change and conservatives, some of them don't. And the most reliable indicator is not education. It's not the amount of information you have about climate change, but really just your political stripe. So it's hard. But two things. One would be that the oil companies themselves, as I just mentioned, Royal Dutch Shell and Exxon, they believe, big businesses believe, and they believe because they have to believe or they have to understand reality. That is a powerful argument. When you look at Coca-Cola, which is in the news recently for, you know, caring about its number one, the number one ingredient of its products, water. So they're worried about climate change. Shell and Exxon, they're worried about climate change. You would never imagine that. And the other thing that may get traction is the military, the amount of planning and thought that the military has put into climate change and the security aspects of it, the amount of time that the intelligence community in general has spent on what this could mean for the planet. You know, you don't find any four-star generals who are climate deniers. You don't find anyone in the Coast Guard who denies that the sea ice is melting and that this is changing everything for them. I think that's a pretty powerful argument because it's not political.
Well, Mackenzie, to the extent that we have been told that individual behavior changes are not enough to really make a significant difference, like it's great if you want to try to conserve energy or make, you know, sustainable purchases, but that's not enough. Does it really matter what the average individual American believes if there are policy decisions and even market forces working toward a more sustainable environment?
Yeah, I think it doesn't matter to have 100% consensus. Not at all. And that's, and we're never going to get that in this or in anything ever in this country. But, you know, it's also like, do you vote? Of course, your individual vote doesn't matter in the grand scale, but that's the point. We all vote, or at least some of us do, because it does register somewhere and you can get a majority. The policy thing, though, I didn't study that in the book. I'm not at all an expert on what the best way to deal with climate change is, but my sense is that there's not enough push in this country to make it a political reality, that people on the street don't care. And so there's the believing in climate change. That's one thing. But then do you actually care enough to do anything about it is a whole different thing. And that's the one that I think we still have a ways to go.
Do you think the response would be different if predictions were that we were going to lose gigantic swaths of, say, the Texas coast or the state of Florida to rising sea levels?
Well, at a certain time scale, those are the predictions, or at least, you know, the Florida coast. So, you know, Galveston, I visited, nice place. I wouldn't want to live there in 100 years if things go as they are. So I think those are the predictions. So there are a few things going on. And one is that, you know, our politics cloud it. Two, we're short-term thinkers, and it's hard to believe things like this. But you're also right that as bad as it will be in this country, it's never going to be an issue of life and death like it is for someone in the Maldives or Bangladesh. You know, not that the Bangladeshis are going to be sitting there in their field as the water rises. Not at all. They're doing quite a bit. But in the Maldives, their country will disappear. You know, the highest point is maybe 5 meters off the sea. They'll be gone. They won't be able to live there well before the sea comes and overwashes everything, just because they won't be able to grow anything. And, you know, buildings will start toppling over. And that's true for Bangladesh. The salt will kill all the rice they're growing well before the waves actually come. So it's just an entirely different thing. And if you talk to people like this, they're saying, well, look, this matters so much. This could wipe our nation off the map. And I think that's the difference. You know, first of all, we can build the defenses to deal with it. You know, second of all, we can move. And so I think there's a little bit of that. I'm not sure how aware people really are of the unevenness, but I do think people aren't scared. And I don't think we will be enough.
You said that mitigation is inherently a pretty democratic process, but adaptation ultimately is deeply unfair. Can you talk about the difference and why it matters?
Sure. Mitigation is just the basic process of trying to stop climate change, cutting emissions. And adaptation is basically dealing with the world we've made or are making. The adaptation doesn't need to be unfair, but as it goes on, insofar as it's local, insofar as it's country by country and city by city, those with more money to deal with these effects of climate change or expected effects are going to be the ones that are better defended, full stop. And if you look at the amount of money that's going into the adaptation funds set up by the UN, well, there's nothing to look at all. Hmm. They're empty shells, basically. The amount of money that the Netherlands has spent on, I think, 18 climate refugees, which are these farmers who lived in a floodplain that needed to get flooded, otherwise the rivers would overflow in more important places. They got paid out as much money as the Netherlands has given in development aid for adaptation across the world, these 18 people. And that's basically true with, you know, a $10 billion seawall to help New York City. That's hundreds of times what the U.S. has done for a climate-specific adaptation aid across the world. Contrast that with mitigation, and you know that you take a bit of carbon out of the air, you don't emit it in the first place, and that does help everybody. Now, I don't want to say that the one is good and the one is bad, or that some adaptation isn't inevitable, because at this point, there's already been warming. There's going to be more. It's cooked into the system. We're dealing with the carbon emissions now from 30 years ago, in the sense that they're what's affecting the climate now, or let's say 30. And 30 years from now, our emissions today will be still affecting things. So climate change is going to happen. We're not going to reverse it, and some adaptation is necessary. But I do think it's very important to recognize that it could be a lot more even than it is, and that that means lots of things. It might mean actually putting some money in those adaptation funds.
Are there serious discussions among nation states that stand to be in a better position to protect themselves, that there is a responsibility to other countries that don't have those resources, or even that it is wise to help them prepare to adapt or mitigate damage simply because those more powerful states don't want to absorb climate refugees?
Yeah, that is happening. And, you know, Europeans and European countries have generally been ahead of the curve on this. But even now, I actually went to the Warsaw climate talks this last November, which is something I would normally not do because it's incredibly boring. but it was slightly interesting walking into these chambers, and you see that no longer is the United States the primary villain. You know, we're saying the right things. We seem to want to come to some sort of negotiation, and that's in part because of these very things you mentioned. You know, we know that the historic emissions have been ours. I don't want to give the U.S. too much credit, but if you look at, say, Canada, which pulled out of the Kyoto Accords and doesn't seem to want to do too much, then it's starkly different than it was, say 8 years ago. But there hasn't been enough discussion, of course, and it's unclear that those talks actually matter, and it's unclear that much matters until we actually start significantly cutting emissions, and that's not really happened.
I was going to say, the U.S. can be saying all the right things and not necessarily walk away from these conversations with any action items.
Yeah, and there were some small action items. It was mostly an agreement to discuss agreeing to things later or something along those lines. But it wasn't a complete failure. And some of the things that came out of that climate accord, or rather that climate meeting, were about paying people who had damages done, paying these countries for the damage done unto them, not by themselves. And that was a big thing. The U.S. fought that, actually, but it did get written into the law a little bit, or it was written into the accord. And, yeah, I don't know that those U.N. conferences they haven't gone anywhere for years. I don't know that that's going to be the place for action, and I certainly don't see it happening in Congress. So perhaps what the administration is now doing, which is executive action, is as drastic as that is we're going to see something happen. I don't know.
The new book by journalist Mackenzie Funk is called Windfall, The Booming Business of Global Warming. He's in town to address the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth this evening. You can find information about that at dfwworld.org. Mackenzie, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Think is produced by Stephen Becker, with Lindsay Connect as assistant producer and Jeff Weddington as executive producer. We had Katie Daniel helping out on the phones. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think and contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.